Thank you very much, and I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to come here. This is the title that I had put up the other day and the abstract, but I was kind of fighting between giving a talk concentrating on this and a talk concentrating on this, which is creating the synthetic brain through hybrid computational and biological systems, repairing and replacing neural networks. And clearly, neither of these talks really fits exactly into what you guys are all talking about. So I'm going to talk about something in between these two, and I will try to relate this as much as possible to the mechanics of the brain, but clearly that's not something that I'm working on for the most part these days. So this title is a large project initiative, and there's about 8 labs that are involved in this. And what we're doing is we're specifically trying to create a computational sensory motor controller. So on one side, we're going to be creating a computational model, which is going to be low level, so it'll actually have individual neurons. And we're also going to do high level computational modeling, where we broaden things and use basis sets, etc. On the other side, we're going to do a lot of physiological experiments, and we're going to be using brain-machine interfacing as a tool to probe, in essence, how the brain works, as well as other perturbations. So, long-term goal is, in essence, understand the brain well enough where we can make a model of it. So, as I said, we're going to use the brain-machine interface as a paradigm to interact with this, and we're going to specifically make a smart brain-machine interface. So, what I mean by that is, so far, most brain-machine interfaces have allowed us to record from neural activity and let the animal or the person control a computer cursor or even a robotic system. However, the only feedback coming to the user has been visual feedback. So what we're going towards now is putting other information into the brain. Specifically, I'm going to talk to you about somatosensory information. Now, we can use that neuroprosthesis, that somatosensory neuroprosthesis, as a way to learn more about how the brain actually processes. So if you take a little part of the cortex, or the brain in general, you could think of it doing 2 different things. One, it can either process information, and that is, information comes into it, it interacts with that information somehow, and something comes out of it. The other thing that it can do is it can start storing or changing the way that it interacts. All right? So we're looking at those 2 different components of how the brain interacts with these inputs. How does LTP specifically play a role in that latter part? That is, not just the processing, but the changing or the modifications that happen within that neural network. How does that store information or change the processing of that system? One of the other probes that we're going to use is force field paradigms. So we have animals or humans interacting with robotic systems. And when the individual interacts with the robotic system, we can change the dynamics that they have to deal with. So if you think of if you're reaching through a waterfall to grab something on the other side, the first time you reach to grab that something, your hand gets pushed down. But after a while, you learn to deal with that new force field. So by using these different force fields that we implement with robotic systems, we can learn how the brain system adapts and learns to deal with these situations. Past that, we can then go into the brain-machine interface world and not just have the robotic system interact with the person, but then have the person or the animal's brain controlling the robotic system changing in different ways that they will have to then learn to adapt with. So we can start parsing apart the sensory side and the motor side, expectations as well as what your planning is. We're going to use a cell-permeable PKM-zeta, which is protein kinase M-zeta, inhibitor to basically wipe out all of a specific type of LTP, that is long-term potentiation. So one of the best theories for how memories are stored these days is through the molecular mechanisms of long-term potentiation. Our collaborators, Todd Sachter's group at SUNY Downstate, have come up with, in essence, first isolating this PKM and then also coming up with an inhibitor of it. So it's a cell-permeable inhibitor that we can inject into certain parts of the brain, and I'll show you basically, in essence, what happens from them. After we do these perturbations, we can then go to our models and our simulations and ask whether or not, given our certain assumptions, if they hold up to these tests. And if they don't, we play the game that we always play, and that is going back and forth between changing our simulations and our models to account for more of the neural activity and the data that we see. All right. So we've got our real physiology, which, like I said, for us is either non-human primates, human primates, or rats. We're then going to use different perturbations to basically allow us to learn how the system, on a short time scale and a long time scale, adapts to these perturbations. The nice thing about lightning here is it represents both electrical stimulation as well as photonic stimulation. So we're getting into the game of optogenetics now, where we can target specific cell types and stimulate them using optics. And then we're going to have our simulation that we're trying to build up. All of this I'm going to skip over, and that is, it's part of a larger project where we're trying to not only learn about the brain itself, but also create an agent that can then interact with the brain-machine interface and make up, for instance, for a stroked-out part of the brain. All right. So the first perturbation we're going to go through is microstimulation, or electrical. And this is on our way to make a somatosensory neuroprosthesis. So what we're going to do is we're going to stimulate the periphery. For instance, let's just touch a monkey's hand. And then we're going to record the neural activity throughout the neural stream. So we could record it in the dorsal column nuclei, the ventral posterior lateral thalamus, and then up into the cortex. We want to see the natural activity that goes along that route. Then what we're going to do is we're going to use microstimulation in the thalamus to try to recreate the cortical responses that we saw to natural touch. All right? So we're basically doing an optimization problem here. By doing this, what we hope to do is find that mapping between stimulation in the thalamus and responses in the cortex. The underlying hypothesis is that if it looks the same, that is the cortical responses, that it's going to feel the same. So here's this simplistic model of what we expected to see. You've got the hand, you've got some receptive fields on the hand, you've got the thalamus, and then you've got the cortex. So if I poke your hand right here, this should then lead to some activation of the thalamus, right? I'm going to call that a stimulus field. So the first goal was to map this stimulus field and then see how that area of activation moves forward into the cortex. At some point, we would like to move past the cortex, well, past S1, and move throughout the rest of the brain regions where this information then flows, and basically follow this information as it goes through the neural process. So the way we do this is we implant hundreds, and maybe this is the closest I'll get to what you guys are talking about. We implant hundreds to now bordering on thousands of microelectrodes into the cortex and the thalamus. That, of course, generally tends to irritate the brain, and that certainly can cause problems like you guys are talking about. But for the most part, we keep that swelling down, and we don't have major problems. Of course, somebody like Bruce might be able to tell you about recordings in these electrodes after a long term starts to deteriorate after time, and that's usually because seems like gliosis occurs and whatnot, and there's a large project now trying to determine exactly what the failure is in these recordings. But over the course of months to a year, things are okay. So we record from hundreds of electrodes in the cortex, and we follow this information through, and we started to model it and ask, okay, does it follow simple rules? And if so, can we make some sense of it? Now, on the somatosensory neuroprosthesis side, what happens when we stimulate in the thalamus? The first thing we need to show is that this topography holds for microstimulation. The thing is, if you electrically stimulate in the thalamus, you don't know what you're stimulating. You can be stimulating axons that are going up to the cortex. You can be stimulating axons from the cortex down to the thalamus, that is, thalamocortical or corticothalamics. You can also be stimulating axons that are coming from the DCN, the dorsal column nuclei, up to the thalamus, etc., or going between RT and the thalamus. So there's a lot of things that could have gone wrong, but nature gave us a little bit of help, and that is the axons going from the thalamus up to the cortex tend to be a little thicker in their myelination, and we might be able to stimulate them preferentially using different stimulus perturbations rather than stimulating the corticothalamics. It works out fairly nicely so far. So here's the monkey's hand. Let's say we touch with just a little Q-tip or something on the monkey's digit. What happens is we see a nice response. These are the thalamic electrodes. We just have four in the thalamus right here, and that's the VPL. We see a nice response on electrode 1 in the thalamus, and we see a nice response on electrodes 6, 7, and 8 in the cortex. So this is the cortical array. This is the thalamic array. And things are color-coded so that when you touch here, it shows you where it's stimulated. All right? Yeah. I'm sorry? This is single unit recording, so extracellular. So then what we did was we stimulated in the thalamus through these bipolar pairs that were shown here. Now, these two responses in the thalamus were weak to touch on the hand, which indicates that those electrodes were probably on the periphery of the core cutaneous area of the thalamus. If we stimulate between a weak and a strong response, you basically see something that comes out to be like the strong response. So from here, 1 and 4, you get a response in the cortex that looks as if you were touching here, at least spatially. We'll have to get into the spatiotemporal a little bit later. First thing is, does it make sense topographically? And yes, it does seem to. This is another visualization of looking at the topography. So these rows are the electrodes. This is the anterior row and the posterior row. What we have is we have two lines of electrodes sitting in the cortex, one being anterior to the other. Then we labeled what part of the periphery is being touched or what stimulus fields in the thalamus are being microstimulated. Now, this diagonal band simply tells you that the somatotopy that you would expect to see in the cortex that we all know about, the homunculus, still exists even if you use microstimulation in the thalamus instead of natural touch. So this is just building up the story that, yes, this topography between the VPL and the cortex holds if you're using microstimulation instead of natural touch to the periphery. So what about the width of those stimulus fields? So over here we have the electrode distance away from the center of the response, either to touch or to electrical stimulation. This is all in the cortical recordings we're looking at now. So we want to see how does the response away from that center change given if you're touching the animal or using electrical stimulation. So here we have different amplitudes, 25, 50, and 100 microamps of biphasic pulsatile square wave stimuli to the VPL versus natural touch. Here's the center of the response. This is the touch response. You can see there's a large response at the center of the stimulus field, and then it decays off as you get further away on the cortex, as would be expected. So if you stimulate too high, you get a response that's much higher. But recall, this touching so far was just at one amplitude. So we haven't yet talked about touching hard, touching soft, rubbing, etc. This is just one given touch. So over here, it turns out that about 75 microamps gives you a response that is very similar to the natural touch response. So the stimulus fields between those two modalities, natural or microstimulation, can be very similar, right? So we're moving along the proof of concept. Now we need to go to, in essence, the temporal domain. Do the fine temporal aspects of those cortical responses look similar? Well, it turns out they can, but sometimes they don't. And the optimization of this is going to be much more difficult than what I've shown you so far. So here we have the natural touch response over a couple different neurons. So these are putative neurons or single units recording extracellularly. Here we have different parameters of microstimulation in the thalamus. And then here's just a comparison of the peristimulus time histograms. The gist of it is is sometimes they can look similar, like between here and here. This is more synchronized or punctate than this is. This looks fairly similar. There's examples where it looks clearly different. And specifically, if you increase the microstimulation in the thalamus up to about 100 microamps, you get this very synchronized oscillation that occurs. And this has also been seen if you stimulate in the median nerve and record in the thalamus or the cortex in humans or in macaques or in rats. So all of this work we are doing across all of these different species, humans, macaques, and rats, to try to determine how much of the architecture of the man, the monkey, the rat, makes up differences in this processing, and how much of the processing looks the same, even though there are these differences in the architecture. This is a single, thank you for asking that, this is a single biphasic pulse. So if you look at the literature, the old literature of electrical stimulation in the human cortex, or even more recently in the VC thalamus, you'll see that it generally takes trains of pulses for the electrical stimulation to be perceived. We think there's a couple reasons for that. One I'll talk about in a second, but these are all single pulse biphasic stimuli, and we're getting these responses that look very similar. All of this work at the moment that I've shown you is in the anesthetized macaque. So, come on. So the rat things are also similar. So here's a rat's paw. We're stimulating in D2. Here is the natural mechanical touch. So this is the peri-event activity over an ensemble of neurons. Here we have the time. Here we have the neurons. Here's the response. Here's using VPL stimulation. This was a little bit more intricate stimulation, and that was two pulses, one pulse through this set of electrodes, one pulse through this set of electrodes. It turns out as you use more spatiotemporal aspects to your VPL stimulation, you can bring down the amplitude of any individual pulse, and you can start actually seeing even more naturalistic looking activity. But this is something that we've only started to optimize, and I really can't see much further than that. So what about the cortex? So far what we've found is that if you stimulate the thalamus, the responses look nice. They look fairly similar to touch. They're usually excitatory. They have the same kind of stimulus field. But now if we stimulate in the cortex itself and then record in the cortex, what we found is, so here is the time of the touch. This is natural touch. This is about 96 or 100 neurons in the monkey's cortex. And you'll see that it's, you know, fairly broad. A lot of the activity is first excitatory, which is red, followed by inhibition, which is the blue. There is some later inhibition that happens as a primary response for certain neurons. But when we stimulate electrically, at least at the given level that we have, and by level I now mean cortical layer, we get a wave of inhibition. And this is something that's been seen by others in the rat cortex as well. You can get primary excitatory responses, but they're narrower than this broad kind of inhibition that we're seeing. This could be why when you just stimulate with a single pulse in the cortex in humans, you don't get a perception. Could be. We're going to have to obviously do some more work on that. There are some parameter spaces where you can elicit a primary excitatory response. So it could be that we just need to search our stimulus parameter space more for the cortex than we have in the thalamus. The thalamus, maybe we just got lucky. It turns out you can use a simple biphasic pulse, and that gets things going. The other thing I haven't talked about too much is in the thalamus, just as if you touch the finger, which is just, say, a couple milliseconds of touch, you get this long, say, 30 to 100 millisecond response in the cortex. The same thing happens with microstimulation in the thalamus. If you just use a microstimulus that's on the order of a millisecond or two, you get this long activity. So it could be that when you're stimulating the thalamus, you just have to set things up. And then you get this oscillation that takes care of the rest of the fine temporal scale. Whereas when you're stimulating the cortex directly, it doesn't seem to work out that easily. At least that's what we're finding at the moment. The thing about the cortical stimulation, unlike the thalamic, is stimulating at the different layers might make a big difference. So far, the probes that we're injecting are all from BlackRock, which is the Utah Array, which comes in either a millimeter or 1.5 millimeter variety. So looking at the different layers for stimulation, we might find a layer that's more appropriate. All right, so the next step now is moving on to using the brain-machine interface as a learning tool. And I'm supposed to stop at 11:45, right? Or, oh, 12? Oh, okay. All right, so then I'll go over this. So using the BMI to learn more about the neural representation. So if you record from the motor cortex or the sensory cortex, calling the motor cortex or the sensory cortex those names is kind of problematic, because there isn't really, at least as far as I'm concerned, this pure sensory or motor cortices. There certainly is a large amount of mixture. So if you're talking about the rat, that's clear. There is a mix. If you're talking about the primate, there seems to be more separation. If you go back to sloths and whatnot, the separation came between the cortical layers, not so much as separation of the cortices themselves. So there's always been this question in the motor control literature of what is it that the motor cortex is controlling? What is it representing? And this debate has gone on for a long time between it being kinematics versus dynamics. Well, the one thing we can do with the brain-machine interface that we couldn't do before is we can now give the animal control over these different variables and ask it to tell us which one it controls easiest and which one generalizes easiest for it in real-life situations, which still might not give us the true answer, but hopefully it'll give us some inclination as to what's really being represented. So the old debates. Now, what we're going to use is things like gain fields, different mass objects, and even curl fields, which are a little odd. And that's, you know, when you make a reaching movement, the velocity is going to scale a force that acts on your hand. And it's one of these force fields that you can't just think your way through. Unlike the gain fields, which are, you know, I'm going to now make it when you move your mouse that the cursor moves a further distance than it normally would. Those transformations you can learn quickly. Things that involve, like, curl fields tend to take a little more time, and you could think about things like dove prisons. When you completely flip the visual field, you have to completely relearn this transformation between the external space and your motor representation. So by playing with these, can we start to tease apart what these different components of the brain are actually doing, specifically in the sensory motor areas? All right, I've already talked about this, and part of the real reason we're doing this is we want people that are missing limbs or paralyzed to be able to control robotic systems that actually function for them. And if you give somebody a robotic arm that they can control just the point in space where this arm goes, well, then when they go to shake your hand, how do they decide whether or not they want to crush your hand because they can't stand you, or they want to be very polite and dainty because you're a child? Well, you need to give some kind of consideration to these dynamic aspects. So that's part of the reason we're doing this. So the paradigm we're using for this type of work is our happy little monkey sits in his happy little chair, and he makes reaching movements to different targets, and he's wearing an exoskeletal robotic system. And the nice thing about this system is we can have the monkey's brain then moving its real arm without its muscles moving its real arm, but the monkey still gets the sensory information back from the proprioceptors. That happens to make a huge difference. So if somebody's arm is truly taken off and you're using their motor cortical activity to control that new arm, without that proprioceptive feedback, there are some serious problems, and it leads to control that can be, well, certainly less than natural. So all of that VPL microstimulation I just told you about also comes to proprioception. There's a different thalamic region that represents proprioception, and it's not as clean as cutaneous, but we're starting to try to work towards that as well. So turns out, with the brain-machine interface, the animals can control things like speed, power, and the force. This is all offline, so that means the animal is not actually interacting with those models. What we're doing right now these days in the lab, so this is just regression analysis. These are the R squared values of how well training our model using two different forces that the animal's working against. If we train the animal when it's just working in the high force environment, how does that generalize to the low force environment and vice versa? So how much of the activity in the neural representation is keeping this kinematic versus dynamic information? So it's there. It seems to be best if you train the animal in the high force activity. That seems to translate and generalize better to low than the other way around. So if you have the animal working in a really slow, weak environment, and then try to have it control in a high environment, a high force environment, that doesn't seem to work so well as the other way around. But now we need to start asking, how well can the animal deal with this in real time when it's really just thrown into the mix and given control? That we are just doing now. This is more stuff from the rat showing that same basic principles hold in the rat. So in this work, we had a rat reaching and holding onto a robotic manipulandum, and he's making reaching movements against different forces. In this case, it was different constant force fields versus viscous force fields, but the same thing turned to work out. And that is, the neural activity can give you the information to control the position against these different forces, as long as you give the model information from these different force fields. So there's a certain amount of generalization, but it doesn't go to infinity. If you have the animal working in a very low field, like I said before, it can't generalize to very high fields. You have to sample the space well enough to have it generalize. Now the stuff that I think is more interesting these days, and that is erasing memories. So for this work, we've been so far using this rat model, which is a pretty simple model. The rat comes up to a slit in a plexiglass wall. He can smell the food. He can't really see the food because his eyes are situated up here. Rats don't see here very well, but they can smell extremely well, and they have whiskers, so they can feel where their arms are, as well as proprioception and cutaneous sensation. And they basically have whiskers on their wrists as well, which are these guard hairs. So the rat smells this pellet. He makes a guided reach towards it. He grasps it. He picks it up, and he shoves it in his mouth. So when the rats first try this, their success rate's not terribly good, but they learn this fairly quickly, and over the course of, say, 10 days, they become very proficient at it. Now, there's a lot of studies that have been done on this and have been looking at what happens to the brain when the animal is learning this. One of the more recent, well, this was 2000. This was probably the first work I know of that showed a strong connection between LTP and memories, sensory motor memory specifically. So this was work done by Don Hugh et al. And what they did was they had these rats make those reaching movements. They would then take the rat, make brain slices of it, and look at the potentiation levels in the two hemispheres. So the nice thing about this task is it's unilateral. The rat's making a reach with just one hand, and therefore you would expect changes in one of the hemispheres and maybe not so much in the other. So they could use the same rat's brain on one side of the control, the untrained, versus the trained. And what they found in the trained hemisphere is that they couldn't really induce any more long-term potentiation. So it seemed, and this was after a couple days of training, that the potentiation had been cut off at a ceiling. Whereas in the untrained hemisphere, they could potentiate just fine, bring it up one step, bring it up another step, bring it up, until it saturates up here. So clearly there were these differences, but does that mean that that potentiation was keeping the memories? I know, it seems ridiculous at this point, but that's how we are. So what else is going on during that learning? Same task, here's the days of training, and this is from this paper, looking at different activity of protein synthesis. This map reorganization is the sensory motor map itself changes as you use it in this task. So for instance, I'm sure you all know that, for instance, like professional pianists, somatosensory and motor representation of their hand is going to be larger than somebody who's not a pianist. So the size and the activity in your sensory motor map changes depending on the use of that part of your body. So first 2 days of training, there's this increase in the motor skill itself, that is the performance, and there's a huge shoot up in protein synthesis. This is seen in the motor cortex, the sensory cortex to some extent, and even the caudate putamen. Along with that, you get this map reorganization that starts in around day 3, and you get synaptogenesis starting in around day 3. So you get the formation of new synapses as well. And it turns out what PKM zeta does is it actually stabilizes the synapses as well as changes the AMPA receptors, which I'll go over in a second. So here's what we did. We took the animals, we had them learn, and this is the success rate of those reaching movements. They reach, they grasp the pellet. If they stick it in their mouth, that's successful. If they drop it or do something else, that's unsuccessful. After they go to the front of the container and they make that reach, they then have to walk to the back of the container, sit there, and then come back to the front. So this task has an explicit component as well as this procedural component. So we're looking at two different memory systems here and making sure that they're separable. So after there's a plateau in the learning, we inject ZIP, which is the cell-permeable PKM zeta inhibitor. And what you see is there's an erasure of the performance. So another thing about asking what is a sensory motor memory is, how do you ask what is a sensory motor memory? There's performance, which is how we gauge things, and then there's the memory itself. So for instance, and this might be a bit odd, but you might remember fully how to make the reaching movement, but if I just take your arm off, you can't prove it to me. So did you unlearn, or is it that you're not capable of performing? So this work has led to more questions, as often is the case. And now we need to determine, is it the sensory receptive fields that have been changed, or is it the motor, the sensory to motor, or is it something else? This change was greatest, I'll go over that in a second, this change was greatest so far in our injections when we injected in this kind of caudal sensory motor region. We also injected up in here, we saw a significant decrease, but it wasn't nearly as clear as back in here, which leads me to think that perhaps injecting here wipes out or changes the sensory maps. So part of the sensory map is probably kept through architecture, and part of it's kept through LTP. This now gives us a tool to determine which part is which, and then make our models and ask, does this make sense? So what about the learning and the relearning? So the animal learns, we wipe out this memory or its performance, we let it relearn. Is that relearning going to be the same, or have we done something fundamental to the architecture? So the relearning is statistically insignificantly different from the initial learning. So the learning rate is identical between the initial learning and the second learning, and it turns out the third learning and the fourth relearning. So now we have a system, an animal model, where we can have the same, I hope, we need to do more microstructure analysis, the same architecture and the same network, learning and relearning and relearning the same exact task over and over again, which is a very nice model if we're trying to figure out how does this area of the brain work, because we can allow it to evolve, follow it, and wipe it out. Do it again and again and again. So now we're recording from the neural activity of this area as we do this over and over again to determine what is it that keeps coming in and over again. What is the stable and the obvious part about this learning that is always there, and what is the part that keeps changing on us? This is just a piece of histology to show, in essence, the spread of the ZIP that we put in. And here's a little video, because right now we still don't know what it is, if it's the sensory or the motor. So the control rats, and this might be hard to see, we've kind of colored the pellet. They make a sniff, and they can do this in the dark as well as they can in the light, which is how we know not using their eyes. They make their sniff, they make their reach, they grasp it, and they put it in their mouth. Whereas the zip-injected rats, they have no deficits in sniffing, aiming, making that initial reach. They have all of their deficits in the grasping component. So the nice thing about that is that we think that the primate sensory motor cortices has evolved to the way it has because of these dexterous tasks. There's certain aspects of motor behavior that really don't necessarily need the sensory motor cortices. It's when you get into the fine haptics and whatnot that you really seem to need this cortical region. So it's nice that the rat model works along those ideas. And what we're doing right now is the same thing in the primate, where we have monkeys making these same type of reaching movements into a little slot. And the learning curves look the same so far. We just need to get to the zip injections. So conclusions and future directions. So PKM zeta activity is necessary for these sensory motor learning. Well, at least I should say the memories. Learning and memories can make people angry as far as using those words together. What about the primate, which is what we're working on now, the sensory and the motor receptive fields, and what brain regions are really the most sensitive, and past just being sensitive, what aspect of this performance and learning are they responsible for? So now we have all these experiments where we have to go through and look at the time course of when the injection seems to matter the most. Look at the expression of PKM zeta. How does it change the most, and in what regions? Go to the caudate putamen. When does that come into play, etc. So this idea about looking at the architecture versus the potentiation, I find interesting because it's something that we can model. So we're setting up our large-scale simulations with a given architecture that we get from the literature, and now we can go back and forth and play this game of just looking at the weight changes. Now, if you let things go on for too long, like I said, synaptogenesis can come into play, and then the architecture might actually start to change itself. That's going to be something that we're going to have to look into and could certainly complicate things. But it doesn't mean that we can't put architectural change rules into our simulations. So right now, for instance, our simulations are already going forward by if we are changing the PKM zeta level in a certain area because there was LTP induced there, that then stabilizes that synapse. So your synapses have basically dynamic aspects to them. They come and they go. They're not just solid structures that never leave. If you have PKM zeta induced LTP in that synapse, it leads to stabilizing it. So when people see these synaptogenesis, what we're thinking is it's not so much that it's new synaptogenesis, it's that you're shifting the equilibrium equation of the synaptic population. So if you suddenly have this LTP induction and it stabilizes a certain subset of synapses, they're now a special population that doesn't go through the same turnover. So it will look like, overall, you get this increase in synaptogenesis, when really what you're doing is you're shifting around the equilibrium. All right, clinical applications. Focal hand dystonia seems to be a problem with aberrant plasticity. There's genetic components to it as well, but there's also genetic components to plasticity. So one of our first trials is going to be, hopefully, to see if we can help focal hand dystonia by, in essence, wiping the slate clean and getting it to start over past the architecture. Post-traumatic stress disorder, our colleagues, the Sactor Lab and Andre Fenton and Peter Serrano, have shown that you can erase spatial memories and episodic memories in the hippocampus. So we're not sure how far back we can go and erase these memories. We know it's at least 3 to 6 months. So for people that come back from war or have other traumatic events, will we be able to go in and specifically erase a given period of time if we get in there soon enough? So that's it. And here are the people that do everything. So the monkey work, for the most part, has been Pratik. The rat sensory motor or learning stuff was Lee and Jordan and Greg. And I think that's about it.